Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, this is Tuesday, April 26, 2011. The first order of business is Senator Perry, Senate File 1044. Members of our committee, we have five bills to do today. We're going to be moving rather quickly. And for some of us, we have to leave by 4 o'clock, so we don't want to waste a whole lot of time. And Senator Perry, we're waiting for a quorum to begin, but I would like you to start introducing your bill, and we can start immediately.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I think we'll start out, while we're waiting for a quorum here, we'll just start out and answer some of the questions that we did have when we were here a couple of weeks ago before the committee. And maybe what I could do is turn it over to Ms. Edie here and let her go down. We had some questions on Section 6, Section 7, Section 10, and maybe I'll just have her run through the answers to those questions.
Please proceed. Thank you. Ms. Edie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Idy. I'm the director of the division, made myself a department, the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management with the Department of Public Safety. I understand there were questions the last time this bill was heard on several sections of the bill, and I'd like to start off by addressing the clarification of Section 7 of the bill, which is the Department of Natural Resources, and the question regarding the substantially damaged. Substantially damaged is a definition that's used by FEMA, which means that the damage exceeds 50% of the pre-event market value. There have been several instances where structures in a floodplain may have actually been damaged a little less than the 50% threshold, and thereby they are not eligible for the federal program. However, it is essential for the integrity of the project to actually remove that structure. So, therefore, we didn't want to confuse anyone by using the same terminology with that federal definition. So, we are recommending that substantially damaged on line 3.119 is deleted.
And Mr. Chair, just for the rest of the committee that might not have been here, that was one of the questions that Senator Latz had brought to our attention and wanted some clarification on that.
Right.
And he has received the same information given to him, and he was okay.
All right. Thank you.
I
would like to have the record show that we do have a quorum at this time. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, there was a question on Section 10 on the Department of Public Safety section on recovery coordination that was raised about the term technical assistance and really what was meant by this section. The intent of Section 10 of the bill was to allow the Department of Public Safety to either hire contractors, which is what we call technical assistance, or to grant money directly to counties, regional consortia, or nonprofits to help local or regional agencies to coordinate that long-term recovery. We have the recovery process of a community, but a lot of times families are really left to try to figure things out on their own. There's financial issues, there's mental health issues, and there are agencies that provide those services, but there is no agency that coordinate those activities for the long term. So we added this section so that we could hire contractors or we could grant money to those local governments to hire some contractor or provide the grants to the nonprofits so they could actually provide that coordinating service. So that was what we meant by this section. There's also been incidents like after the tornado in Wadena this past summer where they created this committee that they called Wadena 2.0. And it was really for what did they want Wadena to look like after the tornado. And also, there's a lot of different funding sources. There's a lot of different priorities, and that would also allow us to grant funds to be able to have somebody to coordinate that so that they can have a good coordinated recovery for the long term. Then the other question I understand was on the nursing home layaway, and I believe we have somebody here to address that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the other question was on an oral amendment that will be coming up. Would you like me to move my oral?
Why don't you bring it to our attention now, Senator Perry?
Okay. I would like to offer an oral amendment.
This would be an author's amendment.
Yes, and I do have two. Would you like them independently or?
Independently would be fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My author's amendment would be on line 3.13, it's on page 3. After the word adjusted, there would be a period, and then we would strike, and license fees must not be waived. We would strike those words.
Does everyone understand the amendment? Any discussion? This is an author's amendment. Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, my second author's amendment would be on line 3.16. After the word state, insert and local. So it would read appropriations for the state and locals share of flood hazard mitigation grants. And this oral amendment would match this with what has been completed in the House.
Senator Newman, would you author or would you move that amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would so move the adoption of the oral amendment.
Any discussion? Hearing none on this author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be at this time wise to have just a brief explanation of the first of my author's amendment on 3.13. So we have a representative from MDH that can do that for us.
Right. Welcome to the committee. Will you introduce yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Susan Winkleman. I'm the Assistant Division Director in the Division of Compliance Monitoring at the State Health Department. We regulate and license nursing homes. The Section 6 of the bill relates to nursing home bed layaway status for nursing homes undergoing some sort of emergency. There was a nursing home last fall during those floods that had to evacuate residents and then undergo some repair period time, and this is language that responds to that very real need. The nursing home, this language allows the nursing homes a lot of flexibility to put beds onto layaway and then take them off without the timelines that normally appear in the process. And then the oral amendment makes sure that they do not have to calculate the layaway beds that were put onto layaway during this emergency into the licensing fees. So there would be no calculation based on those layaway beds for the licensing fee.
All right. Thank you. Any further discussion or questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Perry.
One final thing that I neglected to go over is that it was also advised that we have the have it stated that this bill is effective immediately upon its enactment. That was brought up because of the flooding issues that are currently going on in the state.
Sir, Mr. Backus, do we need to have an amendment stating that?
Mr. Chair, members, I could just read it orally if you'd like. It would be page 5 after line 5, insert section 12. The headnote would be effective date. And it would read sections 1 to 11 are effective the day following final enactment.
Are there any questions? Senator Newman, would you consider moving that as an amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the oral amendment as stated by Mr. Backus.
Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Any further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak for or against the bill? Seeing none. Senator Newman moves that Senate File 1044, as amended, be recommended to pass and will be moved to the Environment Committee. Environment and Natural Resources. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes. Thank you, Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Senate File 1115. Regarding non-native invasive species provisions and modifications.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Welcome to committee, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair and members, what we have before you here, Senate File 1115, is the Natural Resources Department DNR non-invasive species provision modification. I'm sure you're very well aware of the discussions that have been going on not only in our committees and in passing here on the Hill, but also in the media. We've had an awful lot of discussion on specifically a couple different areas, primarily the invasive species of the aquatic nature, which are the zebra mussel, the spread of zebra mussel, as well as the flying carp. There's many different names and different types of carp, two or three different kinds, but I call them the flying carp. That's what people seem to be seeing on TV and in the media, and very concerned about that, and that's why I've worked with in conjunction with the other body to bring this bill forward as a standalone bill because it is an emergency, at least to the fishing community in the state of Minnesota, which of course is a huge financial area of our doing business in Minnesota. And it appears that we're under attack by these invasives, and we're going to try and do the best we can with the resources we have to try and put a stop to the migration. I believe, and I'm going to throw some numbers out here, 19 to 20 lakes in the state of Minnesota now are infested, inland lakes are infested with the invasive species zebra mussel. And what the intention of the DNR, along with other agencies, are trying to keep those zebra mussels in those lakes, quite frankly, and keep them from going to neighborhood lakes near you throughout the state of Minnesota. So that's the immediacy part of the bill and bringing it forth. We'd like to have gotten this taken care of before the opening fishing season, which is, I think, the 14th of May. However, there's been some discussion, Mr. Chair, and you're aware of it, with regards to the actual when this bill will actually take place, and due to the fact that there are some criminal sanctions here, you and I have talked about the possibility of not going with the general area of August of the year, actually moving it back at least to within a reasonable time frame where the public can be educated on this before they can actually be cited for not complying. And it would still be hopefully, should the committee allow us to be able to move forward here and put this into effect and move forward. So with that, I think if I could, Mr. Chair, I've got the A4 amendment I think everybody has in their packet. Maybe we should put that, get that amendment on here. It the A4 amendment basically talks about the first subdivision 3. It's a redefinition of subdivision 3. You have it in your packet, and I would like that that amendment, move that amendment at this time.
Senator Ingebrigtsen moves the A4 amendment. Any discussion? Could you explain the amendment, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. It's basically a better definition of the decontaminant, if you will. If you will all notice on section 1.15, you'll see the original definition. It just makes it more clear. It's been worked on with the interested parties as well as the DNR. and the DNR is fine with the definition, so that's pretty self-explanatory.
Any discussion? This would be, is this the first committee? It's not.
No, it actually went through my committee, Environmental Natural Resources.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to the presenter and have him run through the bill if you'd like. From the DNR, we have Major Rod Smith here who will actually go through the bill. And for any questions with regards to the invasive species, we have Dr. Luke Skinner here. And then we also have Jeff Forster that would like to testify after they're finished. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Smith.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Major.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Major Rodman Smith, Operations Manager for DNR Enforcement. And the Senate File 1115 has a lot of pieces to it. And if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair, I'll move quickly, but it's probably easier to move through the bill in its entirety rather than just hit on a few specifics. It would probably be clear to the members. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 1, 2, and all the way up to Section 8 are either redefinitions or new definitions in the Chapter 84D that are used later on in statute. Section 9 is an annual report, and it just changes some of the current annual reporting that the department does, makes it a little clearer. Section 10 talks about fish that are harvested in that with certifiable diseases, which would be most commonly known as VHS, you may have heard of, which we found in Lake Superior, and how that ties with some of the aquatic invasive species. Then there's also on line point 4.5 to 4.7 under section 10 talks about equipment authorized for minnow harvest, classifying that equipment used in infested waters cannot be used in non-infested waters. Section 11 deals more with Lake Superior and some of the tagging requirements of the equipment is pretty specific to Lake Superior. And then on the bottom part of Section 11, getting to page 5.5 or Part E, talks about basically quarantining water that has been removed from water so that the agency and other minnow and commercial fisher folks actually have to quarantine their water in a holding facility to make sure it doesn't have the invasive species. Section 12 talks about the introduction and notification if somebody does discover an invasive species, that if they recognize it as an invasive species, that they do need to report that to the department. If they don't recognize it as an invasive species, they're not held liable to report it because they don't know it's an invasive species, of course. So, Section 13 deals with aquatic macrophytes, which is basically lake weeds in layman terms. Section 1, the Strucken language, currently it's only illegal to transport aquatic macrophytes on public roads. The Strucken language would just not allow you to transport aquatic macrophytes anywhere, whether it was a public road, private road, across private land. So it's getting rid of the piece of just public roads. And then on the bottom of Section 13, getting to Section 6.2, line 6.29, 6.30, allows a person to, of course, pull their trailer or boat out of the water for purposes of cleaning. So that's covered on that piece. Section 14 just has some technical changes on terminology, aquatic plant control or control device. Section 15 talks about removal and confinement. And mostly it's just the new definitional changes on the upper portion. I guess would be sections line 7.4 down to 7.10. And then subpart 3, part 4 is a prohibition of placing water-related equipment into state waters when we know that they're there and that they haven't been pulling the plug. And then section Part B under 4, line 7.17 to 7.18, we have a definition of an inspector and just clarifies what a non-licensed peace officer who's identified as an inspector, what they can and cannot do. So that's just clarifying their role. Section 16 is transporting water-related equipment. Much of this language was passed last year. It was probably called the pull the plug language, where you have to pull the plug when your boat left the water. We have our new term, water-related equipment. I wanted to clarify that about riparian property and licensed aquatic farms and those exemptions, and then moving over to 8.3 Part E, there's an exemption for pulling the plug on emergency response vehicles and their equipment that are being used in responding to an emergency. We didn't want fire departments running down the road to an emergency with the plug pulled out and getting to the water, and now we have to rescue the rescuers because they're too busy getting the boat in to go make the rescue to remember to put their plug in. So we wanted to have that exemption. Section 17 is inspection of water-related equipment. This is all new language. We'll walk through this a little slower, Mr. Chair. Subdivision 1 talks about compliance inspections, and that folks that are going to be operating or transporting water or operating water-related equipment would be subject to some type of inspection. Subdivision 2 talks about the inspection authority, and the commissioner shall train individuals to inspect water-related equipment. Part B of Subdivision 2 talks about what the inspectors can do. We wanted to be very clear that an inspector can visually and tactily inspect equipment for zebra mussels, mostly how they're transported. They're not transported by the little shells you might see in some of the poster. They're transported by what's called a veliger, which you really can't see. But if you feel the bottom of a boat, it's going to feel rough, and those will probably be those veligers. And Dr. Skinner can get more technical on some of that stuff if need be. Part B talks about how a conservation officer or a licensed peace officer may inspect watercraft or water-related equipment that's already stopped. So we're not giving people if they're already stopped at a public access or at a gas station, we see the weeds hanging, that we'd be able to do an inspection there. So it's something that's already stopped. Part D under line 8.28 talks about conservation officers and other licensed peace officers utilizing a check station, and those check stations would be in close proximity of a public access or someplace where water-related equipment is either launched or taken out of water bodies, and it's clear that they will be operated in a manner that minimizes delays to vehicles, equipment, and their occupants. Section 18 is all new language as well. It is service provider permits. We had a large stakeholder group that helped us formulate and identify some of the issues. And one of the issues we saw were whether it was a cottage industry or a regular industry or small business of folks that would move water-related equipment, docks, boat lifts, boats themselves, trampolines, floating docks, from one body of water to another, that they've actually come to us and found zebra mussels and other aquatic invasive species. So we wanted to make sure that that industry is trained so that they understand the potential risks of what some of their business practices could do to spread those aquatic invasive species. So that that's all new language in Section 18. Section 19 just clarifies that somebody that is a commercial fisherman and their permittee, or working for the permittee, so their helpers would also have to have some type of aquatic invasive species training. Section 20 is the criminal penalties, and encompasses some of the new language that is here, and then just clarifies that transporting aquatic macrophytes does have a criminal penalty to it, so that it encompasses 84D03 to 84D11. And then there's on page 10.3, there's a technical change, water-related equipment. Section 21 gets into civil citations and warnings, and there's some technical changes on there. And then just getting into the pull-the-plug law, which I kind of mentioned earlier, making sure that that's subject to some type of civil citation. Section 22 is the civil penalties. And what we did with the civil penalties, Mr. Chair and members, is we had our stakeholder input. We had a lot of input from a lot of folks, and that spectrum of where these civil penalties should fall were all over the board. For purposes of starting a discussion with you, the policymakers, we simply doubled those civil penalty amounts, and because we're, like I said, there's a lot of folks that want these lower. There's a bunch that want them a lot higher, so we just started with doubling them. And also then, Mr. Chair, members, to kind of move through this a little faster, line 1.10 just clarifies that a person that has one or more convictions can get double a civil penalty. Section 23, watercraft license suspension, it just clarifies the new inspection authority. There was some old language, and we'll talk about that in the repealer. We did have some inspection language in current law that we are going to repeal and under this new 84D0105. So that's just clarifying that. Section 24, satisfaction of civil penalties. One change we're making with satisfaction of the civil penalties is currently any civil citation written for transporting aquatic invasive species goes into the aquatic invasive species account at the state, and then it is appropriated out by the legislature, no matter who writes the criminal or civil citation. This would allow, for example, a sheriff's office to issue a civil citation, and then any money received from that civil citation would go back to that county rather than to the state aquatic invasive species account. Section 25, some technical changes on the receipts. Section 26 is an aquatic invasive species rule decal. It's an education component that discussed at great length with our stakeholder groups and how we get the education out to folks about the not only the new laws but the risks of spreads, and we came up with a aquatic invasive species rules decal, and then I'll follow up with the second half of this piece of legislation towards the end. Section 27 talks about a demand for hearing, and this is more 103G. This would be more about shoreline invasive species. It's not your typical zebra mussel and other aquatic invasive species. And the same with Section 28. It's more shoreline aquatic plant management issues. And as well as Section 29 deals with invasive aquatic plant management. So we're talking a little bit more about aquatic plants and rather wild animals, for example. Section 30 is the temporary warning requirements on the aquatic invasive species rules decal. We're going to put in the statute that only written warnings can be written for that aquatic invasive species rules decal until August 1st of 2013. So it's crystal clear that education component has just written warning implications. There can't be any criminal or civil penalties for that. Section 31 is then a report due to the legislature on 2012 about long-term funding needs for the fight on aquatic invasive species. And then Section 32 of the repealer, 84D02, was what's in current law for inspection authority for the Department of Natural Resources and their inspectors. That's being repealed because of the new language we talked about here today, and that's the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Major Rodman, page 8. Get into Section 17 on the inspections. Line 8.20 talks about required corrective actions. Can you tell me what those corrective actions refer to? What are you going to be asking these folks to do?
Major Redman.
Mr. Chair, Senator, if this would be if they're transporting equipment to or from the body water, if they're transporting it to a body water and they have weeds hanging off it, we're going to make them take those weeds off before they put that trailer or that water-related equipment into the water. So they're going to have to remove any aquatic invasive type species that we may find during an inspection.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Rodman, then if you would drop down into subsection C on beginning on line 8.23. There's language in there that either a conservation officer or a licensed peace officer can stop someone it looks to me like anywhere in the state where if there is reason to believe there is aquatic invasive species present. And I guess my question is, how are you defining reasonable or reason to believe, and do you intend that the licensed peace officer would be, for instance, allowed to go onto private property, perhaps into someone's garage, and do the inspection with or without permission?
Mr. Chair?
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the way the language reads is a conservation officer or other licensed peace officer may inspect water-related equipment that is stopped. So they're already going to have to be stopped, Senator, either at a public water or at a water access or stopped in any other location of the state. And so, and then we'd have to have reason to believe that the aquatic invasive species or aquatic macrophytes is present. So at a public water access site, if we see the weeds hanging from the trailer, or we see, you know, if they were parked at a gas station filling up and the officer drove by and they see the trailer full of weeds, if the officer drives by the Dairy Queen in the boat and the trailer's parked out there and it's full of weeds, it's already stopped. You know, we have reason to believe that they have them there. I mean, we're going to have to build a case, you know, through it would hold up some type of criminal prosecution. So if we did see a boat on private property that was in plain view as we drove by, then we'd have the authority to go over there and tell them they need to, you know, take that stuff off under this. You are correct. But as far as if it was in a garage that was closed, I mean, we'd have to have some type of reason to believe, and I'd have a hard time thinking of a scenario at this time, mm-hmm. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the reason to believe, Major, is you would be able to see whatever invasive species is on this watercraft or boat, correct?
Mr. Chair? Yeah, that is correct, Senator.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm not at all concerned about what licensed peace officers might do at a public boat landing. I am concerned about the language that says any other location in the state. And to me, that language would imply just exactly what it means, including, for instance, in my private garage, or a boat being on private property would allow you, you see something there, you are allowed to go on private property without a warrant and inspect the watercraft. Is that what your intent is?
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that would be allowed under this. That is correct.
Thank you.
Major Smith, on that point, if one of your officers were driving on a county road and they looked to the back end of a 40-acre parcel of land and there was a boat sitting out there, would this give that officer the right to go onto that land and then go all the way back to inspect that boat to determine if there is any aquatic evidence on that boat?
Mr. Chair, I think in reality, the officer would have to have some type of reason to believe that there would be some type of aquatic invasive species hanging off of there. And then, so under this, they would be able to, but I believe they would be able to currently under an open fields doctrine. I don't think there's any, we're not getting into curtilage if you're in the back part of their 40-acre piece of property. So it's a yes and no answer, I guess, because there's a couple different tentacles to it, and I'm not an attorney, but we deal with this quite a bit, and I think that's kind of the way I would be headed with it.
Major, some of us have kind of followed the history of conservation officers in the state and their search and seizure kind of doctrine that seems to be unique to conservation officers, but a licensed sworn peace officer wouldn't be able to follow the same search and seizure methods as a conservation officer. And oddly enough, the state Supreme Court has upheld the conservation officers, much to my personal dismay. But I'm just kind of curious, because I want to make absolutely sure as this bill goes out of our committee to know just exactly what authority you're going to have regarding this. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Chair. And it looks like, to that point, that it also gives police officers the same rights as the DNR to investigate. But my question really is reason to believe also if the plug is in? Or the scenario of, hey, I just saw this guy pull into his garage. Looked like there was something hanging. It looked like weeds. The guy shut the garage door. He comes out, and now you want to be able to get in and take a look at that. I assume you're given the right to do that then.
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, you gave two different scenarios. Okay, currently under law, the drain plug has to be removed. So technically that's a violation of law, so they could be stopped anyway. And there's criminal penalties associated with it, so you wouldn't need reason to believe that they're in there because it's already a violation of law. So that one's a little different. It's currently under law, you can't transport invasive species. So that would be Eurasian milfoil. And what this law change we're asking for is you can't transport aquatic macrophytes, which would include aquatic vegetation that is not invasive, which would be northern milfoil. And really the only way to tell the difference between Eurasian milfoil and northern milfoil is you have a stem and there's all these little branches that come off it, and I believe the Eurasian milfoil has 15 and the northern has 13, so you'd have to count them. So when a car is driving down the road, you can't tell if that's northern milfoil or Eurasian milfoil. So under this new law and under the proposed language, then we would have that ability because we would have that reason. Well, first of all, it'd be a violation of law under the new law just to transport the aquatic macrophytes. But if you did see the weeds hanging, that would probably be some articular suspicion or reason to believe that then that was a violation, that that was subject to some type of inspection, yes.
To that point, Mr. Chair?
Senator Hall.
Is reason to believe, would that be hearsay too? Someone calls up and says, hey, I just saw Jimmy Jones drive onto his property and saw the weeds hanging out the back end. Is that reason to believe for you to go on his property then, back in his 40 acres?
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, it would have to be corroborated a little bit. It depended, did Jimmy Johnson give you good information 15 times in a row, or is Jimmy Johnson the first time he's done it, or is Jimmy Johnson a really bad informant that gives you good information and bad information? So that'd be something that you'd have to build on as part of your case. I mean, that would be with any type of criminal investigation or any type of investigation, law enforcement investigation.
Senator Ingerritsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, Senators, I think in a scenario like that, you would at least have the, under this bill, the way I understand it, you would at least have the authority to inquire. So if Jimmy does call up and maybe you can't even see it, maybe you can't even see the boat from the road, would it be reasonable for the CO or a deputy sheriff, should the CO not be available, to be able to stop and say, did you just come off of a lake? And if they say, no, I haven't been on the lake for 3 or 4 weeks, I think that would probably stop the investigation right there. I don't know that you'd, I mean, you're going to have to be able to go to court. You're going to have to get it past the prosecuting agency as well. They're going to have to say, we're going to be able to go to court with this. So, but it's at least going to give them the opportunity to inquire, because not everybody is going to be seen coming off the lake. You're not going to be able to get everybody. But, you know, all this really depends, and I certainly understand the committee's concern about, you know, what can officers legally do when it comes to rights, and how many, you know, rights do you have when it comes to this. And I think this is a good discussion to have. I am certainly open for any fixes if you see anything wrong here with the bill. However, we have to also remember that we're here for a reason. It's a very serious issue in Minnesota, and we're not going to open up the doors to allow COs and peace officers the right to go in. And as Senator Limmer remembers, the years back when they had more authority than probably some thought they should have had. And I don't want to see that. I don't like to see that myself. So, but it is serious.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Ingebretson, I am going to make an oral amendment regarding licensed police officers, but and I'm back on lines 8.19, in that section. But I will tell you the language in here that talks about any other location in the state is really troublesome to me. And I'd just like you to think about that while I'm making the oral amendment on this other matter. And the fact that we are authorizing a licensed police officer to do this as opposed to a conservation officer also is troublesome to me. So my oral amendment would be as follows, Mr. Chairman. Line 8.22, strike the words "or other licensed police officer." Line 8.23, strike the words "or other licensed police officer." And line 8.28, strike the words "or other licensed police officer." That would be my oral amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Does everyone understand the oral amendment? Any discussion? Yes, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if Senator Newman can help me understand what the concern is with regard to giving licensed peace officers the authority to enforce this particular law.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Latz, the question in my mind really is sort of twofold. Number one, are the licensed police officers trained to visually and tactily know what it is that they are looking at, as conservation officers are? And the other concern that I have, and perhaps Senator Latz, you could help me with this, is the Supreme Court case involving the authority of conservation officers versus licensed police officers in the area of search and seizure. Those are my two main areas of inquiry.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't read the case in a number of years, but as to the training, anytime there's we pass a new crime, the police officers in our state, as part of the regular training regimen within their departments or otherwise, have to be updated on the information and what to look for and how to enforce it and what the criteria are and so on. Honestly, I don't see that this would be any different. There's probably more to it than just counting numbers of branches on a weed, but if that's all there is to it, then we've all just been trained. it may not be that problematic a deal. I'm a bit concerned, especially as we have a challenge in the number of resources available in Minnesota to employ conservation officers, or perhaps as many as might be necessary to be meaningful in the enforcement, that we should at least make available the other resources, other peace officers that are already present in the state and trained generally in the enforcement of our laws. As to the impact of the Supreme Court case, I couldn't tell you chapter and verse what the difference is with regard to the standards. Right here you've got reason to believe, which frankly is a higher standard than for most criminal suspicious stops. All you need there is an articulable suspicion. And that could be based on a citizen informant. It could be based on a whole number of different factors in order to stop a vehicle to investigate whether criminal conduct is occurring. And frankly, if there's a vehicle that's already stopped under current law, you can approach an already stopped vehicle for any reason. So the officers here could approach an already stopped vehicle without any change in the law here. The inspection that could follow of the watercraft or equipment that's related to it, that's where the threshold would come in. And I suppose if they and by the way, that applies to private property throughout the state on all other stuff too. If an officer has reason to believe some criminal conduct is going on, marijuana is being grown on the back 40, they don't have to stop and ask permission at the house to walk onto the land to see if there's actually marijuana there. They can just walk onto the land. They've got articulable suspicion to go take a look. they can do that now. Going into a closed garage is a different constitutional threshold. I don't know, maybe counsel who's busy reading the Supreme Court case can give us a little better idea on what the standards are that are different there. But I'm frankly not so troubled by what's already in the bill before us. Not based on the discussion so far, anyway.
Senator Latz, I think before you came in, we had a discussion about a little bit. We're starting to get into the discussion of what a conservation officer has to allow him to walk across property to inspect a potential wrongdoing versus what a police officer has. And I think Senator Newman and a few of us also believe that by referring to a licensed peace officer in this bill, we would be expanding the search power of a licensed peace officer, which may not be as broad as the conservation officer. And that's why the amendment is before us, to keep the police officer under law the way it is now, and that the conservation officer would have this exclusive opportunity rather than incorporate a licensed peace officer with perhaps an expanded search empowerment. And that's why the amendment is before us. And so I think it's a valid discussion, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could someone tell me how many police officers in the state of Minnesota there are versus conservation officers?
Anybody? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, I'll take a stab at it. You have I think 150.
186 conservation.
186 conservation officers or stations throughout the state, and those are actually down in numbers now because of retirements. As far as licensed peace officers, literally thousands and
8,000.
8,000, I guess, is the number that we're throwing out. So,
to that point. Senator Ingebrigtsen, Chair, I would assume you think the having the police officers involved with this is because of the extremity of the invasive species, and that we really got to take major action at this versus 186 officers with the conservation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Senator Hall's point, yes, I am very concerned about this amendment. This amendment, frankly, would strap the enforcement. I wouldn't say it would necessarily gut the bill, but it would certainly hinder the opportunity to make a difference when it comes to spreading invasive species. Now, understand the way the oral amendment is written, when you take out licensed peace officer, you're also going to take out licensed officers that are working for Hennepin County Water Patrol, every Water Patrol unit that's out there. You're no longer going to allow them to be able to enforce the law. You're also talking about tribal officers that are peace officers that would not be able to enforce the law, which they would under this bill. So I think what we'll be doing is we'll be basically cutting this down to a not even a good try if we went along with this amendment. So I would strongly ask the committee to not support this. Now I have to qualify myself a little bit in saying that and Chief Harrington, Senator Harrington is here to tell you that our police officers that are out there patrolling aren't going to be out there looking for this or doing this. But if the opportunity presents itself, and there is a boat coming from the landing, and there's not a CO available, and the water's running, the plug's in it, and the aquatic invasive plant life is dripping from the back side of it, I think we're going to want that officer to be able to have the opportunity to pull him over and maybe wait for a CO to come on site. We've done that. I keep saying we. In my previous life, we would do that. So we'd have that many more eyes out there, that many more bodies. Can I guarantee that law enforcement's not going to abuse this? I don't know if that's the intent, Senator Newman. I certainly can't. I can't tell you that that's going to happen, but I will tell you that they really don't need the extra work. They're not going to be looking for this, but they are there and available. And especially when you're talking about, I don't know how many thousand lakes. I guess we're supposed to have 10,000 lakes. If we got that many lakes and accesses is, 7,000 some accesses, the COs aren't going to be able to do it themselves. They're just not going to be able to do it. So I would ask to not support the oral amendment.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Major Rodman, can you tell me whether or not the licensed police officers that we're dealing with here are going to be trained to spot these invasive species?
Madam Chair, Senator, we've offered training to county sheriff's departments last year, and we had not a very good participation. This issue wasn't as high on their radar. Many stakeholder groups, cabin associations have met with their local sheriffs. They want their local sheriff's department and their local sheriff's water patrols involved in helping stop this spread. And so we anticipate that the county sheriff's offices and the water patrol, they will receive that training because we will be offering it again. We've also offered training to state patrol commercial vehicle inspectors at the weigh stations. We've had several large watercraft from Lake Michigan come across 94 with the zebra mussel. So we will be training people. We have been training people. And actually, they will be required to have training in order to issue the civil citations.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Given Senator Latt's explanation and the explanation from Senator Engelbretson, I will withdraw my oral amendment. But, Madam Chair, I would like to further explore the language at 8.25, which specifically any other location in the state. I am still troubled by that because that clearly, at least in my mind, would include a definition of privately enclosed property. And so I am a little bit concerned about that. And so at this point, for purposes of discussion anyhow, I'm going to ask counsel to read a possible oral amendment to address those concerns.
Madam Chair, members, on page 8, line 25, you would delete or stopped at and insert a comma. And then before location, insert public. And then after state, insert comma, or a private location where the watercraft or water-related equipment is in plain view, comma.
Thank you, Ms. Pontius. Questions or comments about the proposed amendment? Senator Latz.
Just a question, Madam Chair. So, sounds like the concern that Senator Newman, correct me if I'm wrong here, Senator, but any location in the state presumably would cover the inside of a person's bedroom or front the hallway or their driveway or wherever a boat might happen to be that someone thinks has this stuff on it, and you don't want the language to give authority just to walk through the front door or open up a garage door without consent.
Certainly,
Senator
Newman. Not in someone's bedroom.
That's what I thought. But if it's just in plain view, then out on their property, out in the yard or in the driveway or in the side yard or in the back 40, if you can see it, then your amendment would be intended to allow a visual and other inspection if they had the reason to believe it was in violation of the law. Is that your intent?
Senator Newman.
Madam Chair, given your explanation, Senator Latz, and I am relying on that heavily here, wherein you indicated if there was an articulable suspicion, police officers would have the right to go onto private property and visually inspect, and I am accepting that. It's not my intent to try and change existing law. And that is why I've asked counsel to phrase the oral amendment the way she has. And so in answer to your question is yes.
I would ask the question, Major, there's nothing prohibiting an officer now from getting a court order. Would there be if there were concern that there was an invasive species in a garage, in a boat in a garage?
Madam Chair, I don't know why it would prohibit. Why would they be prohibited from getting a court order?
Okay. Other questions or comments regarding Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could have the amendment repeated, please.
Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, members, on page 8, line 25, delete or stopped at and insert a comma. And then before location, insert public. And then after state, insert comma, or a private location where the watercraft or water-related equipment is in plain view, comma.
Questions or comments about the amendment? Are there folks here that would like to testify either for or against the proposed amendment? Major Smith? Senator Ingebrigtsen?
We're fine with that. We're fine with that.
Thank you. Senator Hall?
Fine, yeah.
Then all those in favor of the Newman oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. We're back to the bill. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Major Rodman. I guess, actually, I wish you wouldn't have pulled the amendment. I don't know. This still bothers me. So I'm trying to figure this out, Senator Ingebrigtsen. But I am not in favor of this bill when it says other licensed peace officer. So I've been thinking about, because I don't think in general a licensed peace officer should be able to do this. In fact, I think they've got more than enough work. And I'll even relate that maybe personally, since in the last 2 years I've had two distracted drivers hit me once in a car and once while I was running. I think they got more than enough work to be out there doing. So having said that, I would like to see, and Lieutenant Counsel could maybe help me with an amendment here, but I don't think just a general licensed peace officer should be out there. But I agree that we need more people on the ground. So maybe you can help me with verbiage, but I would like to do an oral amendment. But my thoughts on it, so I'll get your thoughts so we could do verbiage and see if this works with you. A licensed peace officer with specific area-related training or job assignment. So I don't think the general cop on the beat, as it were, should be able to be out doing this sort of thing. But if they're trained about looking for specific plants or invasive species, or if their job assignments, such as watercraft, water patrol, those folks should be allowed to do this. That's, I think, part of their assignment, and or could be part of their assignment, and they should have that training, and they obviously work in a related area. But I don't want to be pulling cops off the street to just be looking for plants hanging on trailers and things like that. I think there's more than enough things we can be tagging people for that are serious threats to the public safety, as well as the invasive species being a serious threat. So I get a little frustrated when we're given. It just seems to me that every time we open up the discussion and allow somebody to do something else, for example, seatbelts, all of a sudden we see officers have nothing better to do than just do seatbelts, and their whole idea of that was, well, you told us to do it. Well, we didn't tell you to drop everything else and just do seatbelts. It's the idea of public safety, so I don't know if council thinks something that simple could work, or...
You may need some time on that, Senator
okay.
Jungbauer. So
well, that's my idea, and I think that solves your problem, Senator Ingebrigtsen and Major Robin. Maybe you could comment on that, because people that have the training then would be allowed to do that, but if they don't have the training, if they're just... the average guy on the beat, I don't think they should be out there doing it.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Did you have some comments?
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just thinking about my Burnsville police officers. They're, we're in a pretty good-sized city.
But if they drive by Crystal Lake and they see somebody coming out, I would think they all would get a training, which wouldn't be too tough. And again, they'd be able to call somebody that should know. I think these guys know well enough. I think I'd be opposed to that. I like the idea, now that we've talked about it, that every officer in the state of Minnesota is helping with this, because this invasive species is going to kill us and our economy, especially our tourism, if we don't get a real handle on it.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, Senator Jungbauer, I understand where you're trying to go with this, but I must also remind you that, you know, I think our law enforcement professionals in the state of Minnesota are real professionals, and I say that because they're multitasks, not just single dimensional, and if I'm using your reasoning, then if an officer goes to a scene where there's a terrible dog bite, you would certainly want them to be able to take some action with that, because it would be reasonable for them to do that, to quarantine a dog, but they're certainly not going to be dog experts. No different than really drug experts. A lot of your road officers are not trained, but they're not experts when it comes to drug enforcement. However, if the opportunity arises that there's a bag of illegal drugs in the car, they are able to identify that, no different than milfoil hanging from the boat, it would seem to me, that they would be able to also enforce this. So I think, again, this would really strap the enforcement mechanism here, and I would be against, I understand where you're coming from, but I don't think what's going to happen when this bill passes, if it does, that the law enforcement professional in Minnesota is going to say, okay, now we're going to go out and we're going to do DNR things. It's just not going to happen. Let that be the responsibility of the chief and the sheriff to guide them through that, like they have in the past, frankly. So,
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Ingebrigtsen, I have a high regard for your wisdom, but I think those arguments are a little facetious. Every time we put something into law, we go through post-board certification, and officers are trained. And to say something as simple as if they have the specialty training, which obviously we're here talking about the kinds of things in order to identify something, it would be something very simple we're asking somebody to do in order to do that. Or if they're water-related, you would assume they'd already have the training. But if we put it into law, that training should exist for the people that are going to be doing anything like that. So I think it's I just don't think your arguments, they were way off the beaten track there. There wasn't much wisdom to those.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Senator. In the profession of law enforcement, we're handing laws down to enforce to them folks on a yearly basis, I guess you would say, or we've tweaked something, we've taken something and something away and made it tougher, made the sanctions harder. Law enforcement is certainly a work in progress, no different than a lot of other professions. But I think it's short-sighted to think that a simple weed hanging from a boat and a plug in the back of the boat needs a whole lot of training. And I think I'm here to tell you that your law enforcement professionals can handle that in the state of Minnesota. And again, I certainly can't speak for the chiefs and sheriffs because I'm no longer one myself, but my officers would not be going out doing this on a regular basis. However, if the opportunity presents itself, they would still have the opportunity to be able to enforce that, or at least inquire. And by not giving them that, I think we're basically defeating the whole purpose of this bill.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, are you saying that unless we pass this, a licensed peace officer could not stop someone regarding an invasive species on a boat if they came across that?
No, I think this maybe I could have the major clarify that, but I don't quite understand your question. Is it going to not do that?
Well, I'm wondering, and if Major can't answer, then perhaps Council can answer. My question is, do they have the authority to do this now without the clarification, Major?
Madam Chair, this provision of the bill, Section 17, talks about an inspection. So your question about stopping, so having a law violation, they could stop somebody that was transporting aquatic invasive species right now.
Okay.
So section 17 in the discussion we're having is talking more about the inspection portion of it. And once a licensed peace officer or a conservation officer has that reason to believe that that water-related equipment might have some type of aquatic invasive species on it, that they could then do an inspection. Stop, because they're already stopped. So there's it's a little, it's slicing it pretty thin, but there is a difference between stopping for an actual criminal violation, which they can do right now, and then this new language about talking about inspection.
Ms. Pontius, anything further on that question?
No, Madam Chair. I was sort of thinking along the same lines as there's the difference between stopping somebody for a violation or a suspected violation versus just inspecting as a matter of course. So I think that's where the line is.
Well, and that's one of the things I'm concerned about. If it's a suspected violation, you would think that the suspicion comes from a visual inspection, wouldn't you? I mean, it's hard to have a reasonable suspicion if there hasn't been any kind of a visual inspection or you've seen it in plain view. So I'm wondering if we don't already have the authority, that if the licensed peace officers don't already have all the authority they need. And Senator Ingebretson, I'm hearing some concern that maybe we're providing authority that we don't need and sending a message that doesn't need to be sent on behalf of the legislature. Senator Jungbauer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Ingebretson, you know, I guess if we want to persist in this, I would vehemently argue against and vote against the bill and obviously argue on the floor, but I'd love to hear from the different law enforcement communities and love to hear them tell me they need more work. And so when you specifically state it in here, it gives them more work. If they already have some authority, then we don't need it in here, and we could take it out of the bill and make the bill easy.
Senator Letts.
Madam Chair, I think this is the first time of all the criminal penalties and everything else that we've dealt with this year that the argument becomes one of they don't need more work. I don't remember anyone arguing against the other criminal penalties that we've dealt with this in this committee in the past and saying we're not going to increase the penalties on for crim sex because they just don't need any more work. I think if anything, the issue is one of resources that conservation officers don't have to be able to enforce the current laws. I did want to point out for the committee's consideration that on page 10, line 10.6, it's already a part of a step of existing law that licensed peace officers, after appropriate training, have the authority to issue warnings or citations. These are civil citations anyway. So from that standpoint, for exactly the kind of violations that are being referred to in the inspection section that we've been discussing. So if they've got the authority to issue the citations, it seems to me that they ought to have the authority, if they don't already have it, to do the inspection to determine if the violation has occurred. It would certainly clarify it to have it in statute rather than leave those questions up to interpretation. But I did have a question relating to this whole area, which is I'm trying to determine from the way, you know, the bill is put together, we don't have the entire statutes in front of us. We're dealing with civil citations, at least on some parts of these, and perhaps criminal penalties on other parts of it. I'm trying to figure out what is subject to civil citation and what is subject to criminal penalties, because I don't know that there's authority to stop a vehicle that is engaged in suspicious civil violation, but there is authority to stop a vehicle if there's suspicion that they're engaged in criminal conduct. So that goes back, part of the question, to an already stopped vehicle. But perhaps counsel or someone else can help me understand exactly whether the inspection section, 84D.105, or section 17, amending that portion of the statute, I see where carrying those invasive species or aquatic macrophytes as a civil violation is subject to civil penalties under 84D.13. But is there a... Does the criminal consequences in the statute apply to that as well? Because that seems to be more limited. On page 9, section 20, it has criminal penalties under 84D.13. And it articulates the specific provisions in the statute that are subject to criminal penalties, and it does not include 84D.105, the inspection provision.
Council can answer the question. Mr. Baucus.
Madam Chair and Senator Latz, I'm not sure if I followed you exactly, but the criminal provision on line 9.27 includes 84D.06 to 84D.11, so that would include 0.105?
Okay. Thank you for that clarification then. So these would be criminal penalties, and peace officers enforce the criminal laws in the state of Minnesota. Don't see why that is inappropriate here. Essentially, you're them to do their job. As I say, they already have civil citation authority for the exact same violations existing law. So honestly, I don't see what the huge concern is here.
Senator Jungbauer.
Madam Chair, and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I would be most delighted if we would just borrow that exact language to put after the licensed peace officer from 84D.13, I think it was, on page 10, where it just says after appropriate training. We could keep it that short and be consistent with the rest of the section of statute.
Senator Jungbauer, can you repeat that, please?
Madam Chair, if you look at page 10, line 10.5, subdivision 4, warnings and civil citations, after appropriate training, it says that conservation officers, other licensed peace officers, and department personnel designated by the commissioner may issue warnings or citations. So if it's good enough in 84D.13 to have appropriate training, I believe to just use those terms after appropriate training and insert them in 84D.105 when we talk about other licensed peace officers and put comma after appropriate training, and it is consistent with the rest of the statute.
Senator Jungbauer, can you just explain what you're trying to accomplish with that? Are you trying to say that these officers would be doing it only after they've been given appropriate training, or are you saying that only trained officers can do this, or you want them to have training? Can you just clarify what your purpose is?
Madam Chair, members, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I want them to have appropriate training. If it's good enough to have appropriate training to issue a citation, it should be good enough to have appropriate training when you're talking about the inspection. We wouldn't allow commercial vehicle inspections without appropriate training. You can't just go out there as a licensed peace officer and start inspecting trailers and trucks. And maybe it seems simple, but I want to be sure the people that are doing the inspections have appropriate training.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would Senator Jungbauer, Section 8.15, would it take care of your concerns after the individuals and police officers on that line? Would that take care of your concerns?
That would, Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, how that would read, I believe that would take care of my concerns. Shall train and authorize individuals. And yes. That would take care of my concerns.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
That would be a friendly amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, would that create a new mandate for the DNR commissioner?
As far as training, excuse me, Madam Chair, as far as training, I'll have them comment on that. But the training we're going to be doing in the bill itself, just for the operators, they're going to be having some, you know, basically some training anyhow, as with regards to what to do with their own machinery here, what to do with their own boats. I'll let Major comment on that.
Major,
Madam Chair, as Senator Latz discussed earlier, there's already need to have training to issue civil citations, so we could simply roll the training or the inspection in with the training to issue civil penalties, so it would work.
Perhaps council can help us draft an amendment to accomplish that, Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, I did not hear the suggested language. I was working on a different provision, which perhaps I can share with Senator Jungbauer and see if that works.
All right. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, to the lines 8.14 to 0.16, If the commissioner is directed to train and authorize individuals to inspect, I wonder if the term the commissioner is broad enough to include designees of the commissioner. So if it's a conservation officer is under the control of the commissioner doing the training, that's one thing. But if the training is to be made available or to comply with this section through other training mechanisms, something at a post board sponsored event or something else that doesn't directly involve the commissioner doing it, would that be covered, or do we need to add something like the commissioner or designee?
Major?
Madam Chair, there's multiple sites in statute that talks about the commissioner, and we've always interpreted, and the commissioner can designate somebody, and we do designate people, so it would be the commissioner's designee. The term the commissioner, we read that as the or designee. Otherwise, our commissioner would be very busy.
Other questions or comments? Senator Jungbauer?
Madam Chair, Senate Council has an idea on a way to pick it up so that any place in the statute in this section of statute that we use licensed peace officer, it would automatically pick it up.
Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair and members, what it's suggested to Senator Jungbauer is to include it as a definition in Chapter 84D. So it would be page 1 after line 11. We would be inserting a new section, and the section would be adding a new subdivision. It would be subdivision 12B to that chapter. The head note would be peace officer, and the definition would read, peace officer means a person licensed under Chapter 626 who has been trained by the Commissioner of Natural Resources in areas related to aquatic invasive species and aquatic macrophytes.
Thank you. And Senator Jungbauer, do you want to offer that amendment at this time?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to offer that amendment at this time.
Senator Ingerbritzen, were you able to hear the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, if I might ask legal counsel, is this going to then hinder police officers that do not have the specific training to be able to stop somebody that has aquatic invasives hanging or some kind of plant life hanging from the bottom of the boat, and also that they're able to see that the plug is in the boat, it's going to totally take away their authority? Is that correct?
Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, yes. Well, the definition would be that every time peace officer was used in this chapter, it would refer specifically to a peace officer who has had this type of training. So if the officer has not had this type of specific training, the officer would not be able to exercise the authority otherwise given them in the chapter.
Mr. Smith? We have other testifiers that we can hear from if they'd like to testify regarding this bill, and we can come back to this amendment, Senator Ingerbritzen, if you'd like.
It would certainly be fine. Senator, otherwise, I can certainly speak to the amendment now. That's fine.
Whichever you prefer. Senator Ingerbritzen, would you like to speak to the amendment while we have it
before
us?
No, that's fine. That's fine.
Okay.
I think it'd be good to get some testimony.
All right. We have Dr. Luke Skinner with us from the DNR, and we also have Jeff Forrester, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Seasonal Recreation Property Owners Coalition. You must be Mr. Forrester.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for having me. My name is Jeff Forster, and I'm Executive Director of MSRPO. We represent 122,000 families around the state that own cabins. And because many of us are on lakes, I've been hearing about this issue for a number of years. It's really a critical issue to people who are familiar with the lakes. I think it we're kind of like the canary in the coal mine. We started to see the damage first. This issue is kind of a broad-based coalition of a number of different groups and people writing me emails, I assume all of you. And I think it's because what people, they get what's at stake here. With zebra mussels, we're talking about an organism that causes $500 million in damage every year in the Great Lakes. Destroys fishing, destroys boats, destroys any water-related infrastructure like city sewers or even agricultural infrastructure like irrigation. destroys locks and dams and hydroelectric. It's a game changer. And it's in 19 lakes in Minnesota right now. Last year it was in four or five less. So the rate of spread is accelerating. And that's really why I think people are so suddenly engaged in this issue, is people get that in the land of 10,000 lakes, if we lose our lakes, we lose a lot, more than I think people are really willing to lose. We've looked at what's worked in other states, and other states are dealing with this issue. Colorado, for instance, hasn't had a new lake infested with zebra mussels since 2009. And the things that they have in common seem to be, education, which we have, strong penalties proportional to what's at stake, inspection and decontamination. And the third or fourth element, I guess, that is so important right now is last year the lakes that were infested were so-called super spreader lakes, Mille Lacs, Minnetonka, Prior Lake, Lake Hamdou. They literally have tens of thousands of boats moving in and out of them every year. There's 900,000 boats in the state of Minnesota. And so we're really hoping to have something in place by fishing opener is kind of the Senator Ingebrigtsen has stated that as a goal, and I've heard Governor Dayton state that as a goal. And so I'm just here, I guess, to thank you for hearing this bill, and I urge you your support of it, especially the pieces that will make it effective. If we don't get our arms around this issue this year, then it's just going to get sort of proportionally more difficult to deal with every year it goes on and more lakes get infested. Thank you, and if anybody has any questions, I'm...
Thank you. Questions or comments for Mr. Forrester? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
And is Dr. Luke Skinner here or anyone else that would like to testify either for or against the bill or the amendment before the committee at this point? Senator Ingebrigtsen, would you like to speak to Senator Jungbauer's oral amendment with the new definition for licensed peace officers or inspectors?
Madam Chair, I would. Thank you, and members. I'm going to speak against the amendment, and I'm going to try and explain why. I think what we're going to do here is we're really making an awful lot out of assumptions that law enforcement is now going to throw up their hands and I'm not sure what. Put the handcuffs away and not do the more serious crime here and go after aquatic invasive species boats that are traveling up and down the road. Folks, that is not what the intention is of this bill at all. And to take away the authority of the officers that can very simply observe something going down the road that looks suspicious, to be able to pull them over and at least inquire and find out where they're coming from, I don't think that's out of the purview of the professional law enforcement officer in the state. At the very least, if I might address the concerns that I think Senator Jungbauer has, is that there's going to be an awful lot of undue enforcement going on in the state of Minnesota. And if I might then ask, maybe on page 14, when the report comes back to the commissioner from the commissioner to the House of Representatives in line 14.1, maybe something could also be put in. Something could be put in there to report back how the enforcement action went. I'd certainly be interested in finding that thing out myself, to see how many arrests there actually were and why, by what agencies. Maybe that would help with the issue of Senator Jungbauer's concern. But again, to require the post folks to have to go through special training now for something that seems to be very, very, very easy to follow, very easy to identify. And frankly, if they can't identify that by just a simple document in the flyer from the chief or the sheriff to this is a new law that's passed, then they shouldn't probably be out on the road enforcing the other laws. So I think it's just as simple as that. I just would be against taking away the opportunity for those additional eyes out there to stop this, what could be a very, very damaging spread of invasive species in our state. I think it's very important, and I can go on and on and on mumbling here, but that's what I'm doing. I'm telling you, I have more confidence in our law enforcement professionals than that. And I'm not saying Senator Jungbauer doesn't have that. He wants to make it very clear, and I'm okay with that. They're just not going to be out there doing it as often as some may think.
We are going to hear from Senator Jungbauer, then Senator Latz, and then Senator Newman. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Ingebrigtsen. We did, in fact, when we seen the fiscal note on the seatbelt enforcement, it was horrendous. I'd be happy to share that with you up in my office later. Went out of their way. I don't ask that the post board do this training. I think it simply can come if you need training to write a citation for this sort of thing. I think the training can be included in that training. So I think it's pretty simple. I just don't like giving anybody new job responsibilities without some minimal training. And I'm not asking the legislature to figure that out. I'm not asking the post board to figure that out. It can be included. We've got all kinds of little stickers of the boat folks got to have. Operators have to have, we're training owners, and you're saying that we shouldn't train peace officers? I think that's ludicrous, and I think something that simple, and you figure out, you know, however we figured it out, the commissioner can be something very simple. A little placard they carry with them that shows what they're looking for. I don't know what that training needs to be. I'm just saying I don't like giving somebody a new job with nothing to back that job up.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I share Senator Ingebrigtsen's confidence in our peace officers to use their knowledge with appropriate discretion. What I'm concerned about with this amendment is that it would handcuff law enforcement. It'd be like putting a big handcuff around these provisions in the bill. By adding a legal prerequisite to the validity of the inspection or of the of the stop. You know, right now, if an officer from whatever training, experience, life, knowledge, activity as a human being has information or knowledge that gives them the ability to recognize a potential violation, that becomes a legitimate basis for making a stop or conducting an inspection. And if it were ever to come to a question in a court, then, you know, the judge making a decision about whether or not the stop was legal or the inspection was legal as sort of a threshold question would weigh that in making that judgment. If we insert that as a statutory prerequisite that there be a specific training, then it takes out all the other life experience. I mean, if you've got a peace officer that is an avid fisherman, is out there every day off in the summer and knows from reading manuals and online and everything else what these invasive species and aquatic macrophytes, whatever they are, look like, but doesn't get the official training from the commissioner, we're going to say they don't have enough knowledge to make a lawful stop or investigation. I think that really doesn't fit with common sense. If they didn't have any training, they don't have any other basis for the knowledge, well, then, you know, that impeaches their credibility and maybe the basis for the inspection in the first place. But I just soon leave that up. If the question came before a decision maker like a judge, I'd leave that up to the judge to weigh those questions.
Senator Jungbauer, to that point?
Yes, Madam Chair, I think these arguments are ludicrous. I'll pull my amendment. I'll just make it simple and vote against the bill and talk against it on the floor.
Senator Newman?
One quick question, Senator Ingebrigtsen, and perhaps I should have asked the previous testifier, Mr. Forrester, but, you know, are these invasive species like the zebra mussels or milfoil or whatever we're dealing with, are they spread solely by, boats and watercraft, or are they spread naturally by, you know, birds or other animals or whatever?
Madam Chair? For the record, my name is Luke Skinner. I supervise the DNR's invasive species program. And zebra mussels and Eurasian water milfoil and other species are primarily spread by people, human-mediated movement, whether it's boats, trailers, industry, selling water garden plants, whatever it is. Can they be, zebra mussels are typically not spread by birds and things like that. It's, you know, if you look at all the lakes currently infested, they're all high-risk, high-use lakes right now. If they really were spread by animals, we'd see them in all kinds of little places all over the state. We just don't see that. And so just from all of our information, they really are spread by people, and it's our actions that are going to make the biggest difference to slow their spread.
Thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen, final comments?
No, other than, thank you, Madam Chair, other than Senator Jungbar, I'm certainly willing to work with you on some of your concerns here if you have, as this bill moves forward, whether it be on the floor or whatever, but I appreciate your concern. I understand you made the comparison of the seatbelt law, and all of a sudden we've got a lot of seatbelt violations out there, and what you failed to mention was that there was an awful lot of lives that were saved because of that too, they think. You know, but again, that's here we're going to get back into arguing back and forth. I don't think we want to do that any longer here, but nevertheless, this is a very serious thing. We take it very serious, and I appreciate the conversation that's going on here. This is something I think that, again, is a work in progress. We're going to get a report back from the DNR by the 15th of 2000 and, January 15th, 2012, and I would look then for even some more work on this. And we'll hopefully we'll get a good report back that we're not getting infested any worse than what we have here in Minnesota. So, with that, I have no other comments, and would certainly like to move the bill if I could.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, there is one other issue we should probably address, which is the effective date proposed in the bill. Senator Limmer asked me to make sure I brought that up. He's got some concerns about the effective date. Would you like to address that issue?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And we did talk about that, as I did in my opening remarks with Senator Limmer before the committee, and most generally, where there's sanctions like this, the effective date isn't until August of the following year, this year. And we did talk about we would like to have seen it effective immediately, but we understand the concerns of the committee as far as, again, educating the public on what the sanctions will be and just how that goes forward. So we did stop with an agreement giving it a month out from the opening fishing. That was our biggest issue. The majority of the boats are going to be on the road and coming in and out of the accesses on the opening fishing season, so we would go a month after that, and we agreed on June 13th that that's acceptable to the committee.
And that would be an amendment, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Is there a member that would like to offer that amendment to the bill?
I would so move.
Senator Newman moves. Online, let's see here. Page 14. Mr. Backus has the language.
Madam Chair, members, if you on line 14.9 to 14.10, if you delete the day following final enactment and insert June 13th, 2011, and apply to crimes committed on or after that date, so it'd be those sections are effective June 13th, 2011, and apply to crimes committed on or after that date.
Senator Newman, acceptable language to you?
Yes, and I would move the amendment.
Thank you. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Mr. Backus, would that apply to civil infractions committed on or after that date as well?
Senator, Madam Chair and Senator Latz, yes. This is generally how we do it. We just say crimes committed after. I've never run into a problem with that. You could say offenses committed on or after that date if you'd like.
Violations, yes.
Violations would probably be better then.
Senator Newman, would you like to make that change to your oral amendment?
Yes, I would incorporate the word violations into my oral amendment.
All right, and Mr. Backus, would you read the amendment one more time?
Madam Chair, it'd be lines 14.9 to 14.10, delete the day following final enactment and insert June 13, 2011, and apply to violations committed on or after that date.
Everybody understand the language before us? Senator Ingebrigtsen, comments on that?
No comment. Thank you. That's fine.
Are there folks here that would like to testify either for or against the amendment before us? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Now, final action on the bill. Senator Newman, would you like to move that this bill go to... Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'm sorry. Senator Ingebrigtsen, would you like to move that your bill move to the Finance Committee?
Senate File 115 as amended to the Senate Finance Committee.
Thank you. Are there folks that would like to testify about the motion? Senator Letts.
Is there a fiscal note on the bill?
Senator Ingebrigtsen, is there a fiscal note on this bill?
Fiscal note, Madam Chair, Senator, the fiscal note was not put out here because the funding source that, as you probably didn't hear this, I'm not sure whether we were here or not, with the funding was appropriated through the Environmental Natural Resource Finance Bill, and that's how it's being appropriated now.
Mr. Turner, additional comments?
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, there is a fiscal note, as Senator Ingebrigtsen said, there's no general fund money, no money that is connected to the jurisdiction of this committee. The bill, the expansion of enforcement and inspection is funded in the Game and Fish Bill. And although there is an expansion of misdemeanors here, I can confidently say, obviously, there's no state correctional cost, and there would be minimal local correctional and supervisional cost.
Thank you. Other questions or comments regarding the bill and Senator Ingebrigtsen's motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
Senate File 1115 has been recommended to pass and move on to finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I understand you are also going to present Senator Scheid's bill on her behalf today, Senate File 172, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, I have been asked by Senator Scheid's office to, as I'm a co-author on this bill, and I'll have Mr. Knopf probably go through the bill if you have any questions, but it's a technical change. I think we have a testifier here as well. At least I have it on my Luke Pappen. Is he here? I guess not. We'll just go ahead and move forward with this. This is with regards to titling, and I'll have Mr. Knopf go through the bill real quickly if I could.
Thank you, Mr. Knopf.
Madam Chair, Greg Knopf, Senate analyst. It helped Senator Ingebrigtsen. I worked with Senator Scheid on this bill, and the first section is just is basically a technical clean up some old language on laws of 1989, basically getting the right cross reference. Sections 2, 3, and 4 are all sections dealing with changing the way the title works to make it to match up similar with car titles. When this passed in 1989. The same year, automobile title, the process was changed, and they used the old version in this. So it was kind of ironic that it was in the exact same year that it was changed. But this is going to finally, after all these years, change it to the same process where the certificate of title is actually mailed to the owner. So this is matched to, or written to match exactly with how a car title works in sections 2, 3, and 4. And section 5 just eliminates a waiting period, which is tied to who the duplicate title was issued to. And so that, Madam Chair, unless the committee wants more detail, is what it does. Again, it's more in line, or it is exactly in line with the way an automobile title works. It's bringing the watercraft titling up to speed with that. And so this would then allow the title to go forward to the owner and create under the same system that a car title works today.
Mr. Knopf, I'm sure if there were some way to make this controversial, we could do it here in this committee, but I don't think that we're going to do that this afternoon. Are there any questions or comments regarding Senate File 172? Senator Ingebrigtsen would move that Senate File 172 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor.
That is correct.
Any questions or comments from members, folks that are here to testify either for or against Senate File 172? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Senate File 172 is recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. We have Senator Newman and Senate File 471, the Driver's License Reinstatement Diversion Pilot Program. Senator Newman, we've been saving up for you because of the last bill. So, Are you ready to go, Senator Newman?
Yes, Madam Chair, just one moment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 471 is a driver's license reinstatement diversion program and is an extension of a current program which was due to sunset, and it's also an expansion of a driver's license reinstatement diversion program which will allow counties to become involved in this, in the program. And you know, in a nutshell, what this bill does is allows certain drivers who have lost their driving privileges to have their driver's license reinstated and then pay off the penalties on a monthly basis or on a payment plan, and thereby hopefully helping them get back into society. And there is some evidence that this program in the past has worked quite well, and with that, I would move Senate File 471, I believe. I would move that the bill be recommended to pass and move to the floor. I do have with me two testifiers. The first is Mr. Scott Atkinson from Diversion Solutions Incorporated. And Mr. Atkinson is the individual who owns a private company that, in effect, operates this program. And I will have him explain to you exactly how that is working. Madam Chair, Mr. Atkinson.
Thank you. Mr. Atkinson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. We're asking for an extension of the pilot due to how well the program itself is working and some of the items that we would like to iron out in support of individuals on helping them receive their driving privileges back. And just as an overview of the program, when we first had the law passed, the anticipation was that we would bring 350 individuals into the program over the first year of the pilot program so we could refine the program itself. We are about 18 months into the program, and last year in 2009 was our full year. We evaluated 4,400 individuals instead of 350. Mm. We were 2,100 of those individuals were allowed to participate in the program. And the program itself, when we started also, we chose an arbitrary percentage that of success. And that success number that we chose when developing the program was 15%. If we could keep 15% of our participants active within the program and in good standing within that program over a 12-month period, we thought that we'd be very successful, and then we could work toward more success on top of that 15%. Last year, in our first full year, we have kept 77% of the individuals in good standing within the program. The program itself brought back in payments on fines and fees of over $400,000 in its first year with five pilot cities within the program. And our pilot cities are St. Paul, Duluth, West St. Paul, South St. Paul, and Invergrove Heights. So we took a larger community and we brought it all the way down to a smaller community to make sure that this program will work with everybody that it's supposed to support and with the city attorneys in it. This year, with a small expansion of Minneapolis and possibly a few counties, we anticipate this program will bring back to the state around $1.5 to $2 million in paid fines and citations, along with keeping these people legal. The program also demands that they carry insurance and show proof of insurance on a regular basis. So we're actually monitoring all individuals, all participants within the program on a pretty much a monthly basis. And that's what makes the program successful.
Mr. Atkinson, can you explain? I'm puzzled what your group, the Diversion Solutions, does. What are the services you provide, and how are you paid?
Okay. First, Madam Chair, first of all, we are paid by the participant. So the program itself, there's a $300 fee to come into the program, and that is paid by the participant over a payment plan along with all the fines and fees that we set up with them. What we do is we manage the program for the city or the county attorney's office. And so we're the management arm. It's our responsibility to take all the information on a future participant. We will deal with the participants and bring that information forward to DVS, who we work very closely with. We then bring all that information over to the city attorney's office, which would be Jessica's to my right, who does a review on individuals that would like to participate. We then manage the individual, the payment plans. We are also required by law to provide them with a four-hour management class on proper driving, how to be responsible, and we dig into a responsibility and also all the way through financial management classes for these individuals that we are required to provide. And then we are required to report all this information back to the city attorneys that we currently work with. So we manage the individual themselves.
And Mr. Atkinson, is your company then the only provider, or will there be potential RFPs for this service? Are there other vendors that might be interested in doing this work?
I think, Jessica, you would have to somewhat answer to that. At this time, we are the only individual because we are in the pilot stage, the only company.
Madam Chair, I have Jessica McConaughey, who is with the St. Paul City Attorney's Office, that could answer any legal questions that you may have regarding this matter.
Ms. McConaughey, welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Jessica McConaughey. I am an assistant St. Paul City Attorney. I've been the prosecutor who has helped and been developing this program from day one. For the last 2 years, as of right now, Divergent Solutions has been the only third-party administrator. And the way that the law is currently written, it does talk about the selection of a third-party administrator. Because we had used Divergent Solutions, a branch of Mr. Atkinson's company in the past, with some of our other programs, our theft diversion program, our check diversion program, we actually approached Mr. Atkinson and said about one-third of our caseload, and we're dealing with 15,000 to 20,000 cases a year. At that point in time, about one-third of our caseload was driving after suspension, driving after revocation cases. We actually approached Mr. Atkinson and his company and said, we would like to work with you. Would you like to work with us to help us solve some of this problem? And it was at that point in time that he did agree to come on, probably not knowing exactly what he was getting himself into, because a lot of what he has funded, both with his own technology and development of his program, is through his own funds and resources as well as the participant fees. So at least right now, in the current legislation, the third-party administrator has been selected. And I believe in the current proposed legislation to expand and extend this pilot program for the next 2 years, it does say, along with the under the commissioner's direction, there have been other particular third-party administrators who have approached us and said, we are interested in this, but have not yet been able to deliver or establish the type of program that we are looking for. So we do anticipate at some point, if after another two-year pilot program, that this does open up and go to statewide, that we probably will be looking for proposals at that point in time. Hopefully by then we'll have a better understanding of exactly where we are at with this program and what issues, if any, we still encounter at that point in time. My role as the prosecutor to be here today to basically speak on behalf of the other prosecutors, the other pilot cities who are involved, as well as the good relationship that we've had with the driver vehicle services regarding this program. I'm certainly here to answer any questions that this committee might have, but what I will say is that the last 2 years, last 18 months almost, that we've been working on this program, we have seen good results. It has hopefully lowered the amount of new cases, new driving after suspension, new driving after revocation cases that are coming into the system. This really is kind of a pragmatic approach between a private and public partnership, and we would like to see it continue for another 2 years at a minimum so we can really help ensure that we are doing what's best for public safety by ensuring and hopefully promoting people to have valid licensed drivers on the road, and to make sure that people are, in fact, cleaning up all of their outstanding court fines and court costs that are out there that now prohibit or prevent them from being able to drive legally.
Thank you. Senator Harrington, did you want to comment?
Madam Chair, only to say that I support this bill. While I was chief of St. Paul, my officers worked with the city attorney's office, with John Choi, who helped put this program together. We saw great success in terms of reducing the number of folks who were out there who were driving with invalid driver's license. We did not see any real negative consequences to this diversion program. I think it was good crime prevention. It was money well spent, and it was a relief on both the city in terms of its prosecutorial end and the law enforcement end. So I would support the bill.
Thank you. Senator Newman, it sounds like a great proposal that's working and should be continued. I would hope, though, that the city and diversion solutions would be working if this gets enacted towards developing that criteria. What is the minimum set of requirements for a business that's going to provide these services, and how do we make it competitive and not just create the monopoly, if you will? It's too small at this point to be a monopoly, but at some point it could become one. And so I do think that the city has some responsibility, if they want to come back again in a couple of years, make sure that you're ready with criteria to go, so that if it gets further expanded, there's an opportunity for others to provide these services.
Good point, Madam Chair.
Other questions or comments? Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the witnesses may know, at what point in the process does the accused get diverted into this program? If you already said that before I walked in, then I apologize.
Ms. McConaughey.
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, as a prosecutor, we like to say there is no wrong door to come into this program. And essentially and ideally, what we would like to happen is that the person gets informed of this program at the time of the citation. In the pilot cities, at the time that an officer stops an individual for driving after suspension or driving after revocation, we do provide our officers with what's called an orange card. And the officer, at the time that he or she writes the citation, at the same time gives an orange card to that offender, and it basically says on the orange card, you may be eligible to participate in the driving diversion program. Please call this 1-866 number, and they'll give you further information about the program. So with any luck, it's happening right at the time of the citation. Now, we know we don't live in a perfect system, so what happens is people who have an outstanding, and we define that as something that hasn't been paid or cleared up yet, as long as they have an outstanding citation of a DAS or a DAR in the pilot city, whether it be while at their first court appearance, their second court appearance, or maybe it is sitting with the Traffic Violations Bureau, they can go in to see a hearing officer, and we are giving those individuals the option at that point in time as well. So we do try to make it available at any time, and then on the other side, we work to make sure that if they are successful, that a lot of times that those particular citations will probably be dismissed.
Senator Latz.
Chair, I know these driving after withdrawal cases can become a merry-go-round for individuals who just can't come up with the money or don't get around to getting reinstated. And then they get another citation, and then it just gets, the hole is deeper and deeper. Do you have any specific criteria, for example, in the city of St. Paul, that says if you have X number of violations on your record, you don't qualify for this? Or at what point, how do you help them get off the merry-go-round, other than just saying, if you got this violation, you might be eligible?
McConaughey.
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, we do have criteria for our program, and we can certainly provide that to this committee. The initial criteria, if you will, is that the person has to have their driver's license, their privileges, either have to be suspended or revoked, and that's kind of the starting base. So if somebody is canceled, or if they're canceled as inimical to public safety, they would not be eligible. So on a DAS, driving after suspension or driving after revocation, that's the initial query that we take a look at. If somebody has 20, 30 different driving after suspensions, does that make them ineligible? In and of itself, no. What we have to further look at is the suspension for child support reasons? If so, they are not. Then this program is not available to them. Do they have a commercial driver's license? If so, then this program is not available to them. Do they have a criminal vehicular operation on their driving record? If so, this program is not available to them. So we start working down our list of criteria, which actually one would think that, geez, that might throw out a lot of people who might otherwise be eligible. And what we have found is that the opposite is true. So people who typically, as a prosecutor, they might come into court and I might say, wow, you have 30 driving after suspensions on your record. Why should I give you an opportunity? That thinking, we have started to change that culture of thinking. And the culture now is let's give them an opportunity to succeed. And here is that one bite at the apple that but for this program, they might not have. A lot of different jurisdictions do what's called continuance for dismissals, where they basically, a prosecutor or a hearing officer says, okay, you come in, you pay me some money, and you agree, pay the court, you agree not to do this offense in the next year, and it won't go on your record. That's great for that one isolated case, but it doesn't help the offender, the driving offender, actually clear up their record. And what this program does is it does give the driving offender the ability, albeit with certain conditions, to be able to clean up their record if they want to and if they elect to try and do what the conditions of the program do. So it is kind of a change in culture. We are working with public defenders, with defense attorneys. We've talked with probation. We've gone out to community meetings. People tend to understand this, and as long as they contact us and we are able to go through our criteria and they do appear to qualify, we're going to give them the opportunity to succeed.
Thank you, Senator Letts.
Thank you. I'm sorry, just another follow-up. How do they clean up their record if the record consists of violations that have already for which they've already been convicted?
Ms. McConaughey.
Madam Chair, Senator Letts. Part of what we have created in Minnesota with a lot of our offenses now being on the payables list, and I'm sure this committee is very well aware of certain offenses that have ended up on the payables list, which offenses otherwise would have gone through court. So charges like driving after suspension, driving after revocation, no proof of insurance, those types of offenses are actually on the payables list. And what happens now is that those offenses, an officer gives a citation for driving after suspension, no proof of insurance, speeding. The person can either elect to either do something about it or elect not to do something about it. And if they elect not to do something about that citation, they never have to see the inside of a courtroom. What happens is that the court will send information to the driver vehicle services, and their license will be suspended, what's called for failure to appear or pay. So unless and until that person decides, I want to clean up my license, there is no guilty verdict on the misdemeanors. On the petty misdemeanors, yes, a failure to appear or pay will default to a guilty verdict. But on the misdemeanors, no. So on these payables where they've never made a court appearance, at the time that we give them information and they agree to be in the program, we ask them to sign a waiver, a legal waiver that basically says, I understand by paying this dollar amount on this citation, it's going to be a guilty plea. So on those cases that never see the inside of a courtroom, we tell them you can either have it put into your driving diversion program payment plan, or you can elect to go down and talk to a court and or a hearing officer and have your day in court. So we do give them that option. On cases where a guilty verdict has already been had and a fine was imposed and they don't pay it within the 30-day time period or the period that the court gives them, at the end of that time period, the court, and it's not paid yet, the court then sends the info to the driver vehicle service, and again, they suspend the license for failure to pay that fine amount because a conviction has been had. So again, the person can still go about their business. They can either drive or not drive. Most, unfortunately, tend to drive, even though their license is suspended. So we're actually putting that dollar amount, anything that's affecting their driver's license status, we're putting that dollar amount in the payment plan. They pay off it. The driving diversion program pays the court. The court then, once they get the amount in full, will clear that and send a notice back to the driver vehicle services for a driver's license reinstatement.
So,
thank you.
So, Madam, Senator, I appreciate the description, Ms. McConaughey. So for those who have accumulated a series of payables that haven't been paid, if you will, this is a way to clear all of those out and undo the suspensions that are related to them. You can clear out the backlog, not just the particular citation that led to them getting into the diversion program.
Ms. McConaughey.
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, you are correct. That's the intent and how this program is playing out.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Newman has moved that Senate File 471 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. Are there other questions or comments from committee members, or questions or comments from the folks here in the room that would like to testify? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Senate File 471 is recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. Senator Newman, you also have Senate File 680 regarding the crime of organized retail theft.
That's fine. Okay.
Senator Newman, is this the first hearing for this bill?
It is.
And Senator Newman, then I understand there's an A1 amendment. Is that an author's amendment that you'd like to add to start here?
No, one moment. We had Thank you, Madam Chair. It is an author's amendment, and I would at this point offer the A1.
Thank you, members. It's being distributed right now. It is an amendment offered to put the bill in the shape that the author would prefer. Senator Newman,
it's you and me.
Senator Newman moves the A1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Senator Limmer, there's no tie. The amendment is adopted, Senator Newman. Senator Newman, I just passed an amendment, Senator Limmer. Senator Newman, if you'd like to describe your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Senate File 680 is the organized retail crime bill, and the thing that I'd like the committee to keep in mind, that this is not about shoplifting. This is about a large-scale criminal operation that involves a number of individuals or teams that are well connected, and that they have specific roles with the intent to move into a store and steal a large amount or a large number of products in order to support their criminal activities and lifestyles. And this is a problem that has increased significantly in recent years, and is the reason why we have come forward with it. And I do have testifiers that will help us understand the bill a little bit, but to the purpose of the A1 amendment, just so that you would understand, is it removes the question of the fiscal note, and that was the intention of the amendment. So to the bill itself, I will allow the testifiers at this point to proceed.
Welcome to the committee. Could you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, Senator Brian Steinhoff, Minnesota Retailers Association.
I want to thank you for your time and thank the senator for his leadership on this important issue that's really become a big deal for retailers in Minnesota and throughout the country. The senator said it great. This is not just shoplifting. This is going after a large, organized, very sophisticated group of criminals that are out there and, you know, essentially raiding stores, retail stores across the state, you know, taking that product and moving it to market. There, you know, use distribution systems, warehouses, and all sorts of different mechanisms to get that product to market. These crime rings usually consist of terms like, and folks like boosters, which will go into the store, like I said, and they'll be made up of a team, and each members of these teams will have different roles. One member of the team may have the role of distracting the security staff, while the other members gather, you know, the goods and get out the door with the merchandise. Oftentimes, they're going after professional household items like DVDs, CD players, that types of things, health and beauty items, over-the-counter medicine. And it's made it much easier. The internet, in especially the growth in internet auction sites, has made it much easier for these criminals to get the products to market. They can often warehouse these goods and then pretty much anonymously get these products to market. So the consumer's going to various different web pages, looks like a normal web page, they're finding that product for a lot better deal than they're finding it in the store, they hit click, buy the product gets back into the market. And where this can become a concern, especially for health and safety reasons, is that a lot of the products that are stolen are baby formula, like I mentioned, over-the-counter medicines and things like that. So the problem becomes, were those products stored in the correct temperature, the correct place, how long were they stored there, was the expiration date manipulated? So those are some of the issues we have with getting these products back to market. 90%, the retail industry in the United States, 90% have reported in the last year they've been victimized by organized retail crime. The National Retail Federation estimates ORC, or organized retail crime, accounts for $15 to $30 billion in lost sales. Now, in Minnesota alone, that contributes estimated about $33 million in lost tax revenue in this state. Legislation strengthening ORC prosecution has been passed in 24 different states. This legislation, as amended, would add felony theft to the definition of criminal acts under Minnesota's racketeering statute. Minnesota Retailers Association supports this legislation. We feel it creates more tools for law enforcement and prosecutors to go after ORC crime rings. With that, thank you.
Any other discussion? Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself?
Mr. Chairman, Jamie Poole with the Minnesota Grocers Association, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today. The Minnesota Grocers Association is a trade association representing the retail food industry since 1897. We have over 200 retail members with nearly 1,100 stores statewide, as well as approximately 100 distributors and manufacturers. Our member companies employ over 125,000 union and non-union Minnesotans. This challenging economy, grocers work diligently to make every penny count. This allows us to bring the greatest value to dollars spent to Minnesotans. Organized retail crime is a cost that we can't afford to bear. That is why the Minnesota Grocers Association is here in support of Senate File 68. Organized retail crime, as Brian stated, is one of the fastest growing security problems facing our communities. The items that commonly are targeted in grocery stores are the inexpensive household items, such as over-the-counter drugs, the expensive razors, batteries, baby formula. All of these are commonly sold in all of your community grocery stores, and this affects all sizes, large and small. After these products have been stolen, the boosters resell them on internets and through fencing operations or flea markets. This is very different than petty shoplifting and represents potential hazards to consumers. Groceries and manufacturers take very seriously the integrity of the products that they sell and manufacture. This unscrupulous way of selling products can result in package tampering, altered expiration dates, and it creates a dangerous and compromised products for Minnesotans. We work closely with law enforcement to put all appropriate measures in place to reduce risk and create a safer shopping experience. We extensively have in-house training for our staff, but that's not enough to combat a problem of this magnitude. As Brian stated, 24 other states have already passed very similar legislation. I'd like to just tell you a brief case study
In Polk County, Florida, a ring of 13 suspects operating against an extensive organized retail crime ring. Two men would go into the store while a driver waited outside. One of the men would fill a shopping cart with formula and walk away while the other man acted as a lookout. The women would then also fill oversized bags with formula and leave the store. By rotating, many cans of formula were stolen, and all of this happens in the course of 15 minutes. These criminals would then take the baby formula to a storage unit. Once they had a large amount of formula, they notified the upper-level fence or the kingpins, which is who we're going after, who removed the formula from the state and sold it. In this case, 21 arrests were made, and it is estimated that in 1 year, this single group stole $2.5 million worth of baby formula. And over the seven-year life of this crime ring, they stole $17.5 million worth of formula. The formula was obviously not kept dry or in cool conditions, and the product was obviously not preserved. It is likely this was sold to low-income mothers who unknowingly fed possibly tainted product to their newborns. While this particular example happened in Florida, and the suspects are based out of Atlanta, they're very mobile, and with the criminal enterprise as far-reaching, especially with the increase of Internet access today. In closing, we believe that the committee can do great justice in supporting this bill, and we ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
I also have Mr. David Brown from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. I would ask that he come forward and explain the bill from the perspective of the prosecution.
Mr. Brown, welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm David Brown. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. I'm here on behalf of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I know the hour is late, so I will be brief. This is a very small change that can have a very big impact on retail theft. By adding the crime of general theft to the RICO statute, we avoid criminalizing typical shoplifters. This requires an organization, and it requires three separate criminal acts. So there's no chance that we're going to be pulling in a couple of kids that go out and shoplift. This requires organization. It requires a separate entity under some Supreme Court case law. And by having multiple acts, we're going after the people that the grocers and the retailers have identified. The other benefit to adding it to the RICO statute is that under the sentencing guidelines, it's not ranked, which means the judge has the power to figure out not only what should the severity be, but even within an organization can tailor the penalties based on the involvement. So we think, as I said, it's a very small change that can have a very big and positive impact. And unless there are further questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Any other questions? Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, I just want to speak in support of the bill. Beyond the retail part of this, having run a RICO operation going after one of the major gangs, one of the things that most people don't realize is that the gang operations have gone beyond simple narcotics and prostitution and have gone into retail theft, organized boosting, and resale on a fairly massive scale. Our operation took down a group that was taking laptops and electronics and you retelling those. So I think this is an excellent bill. I think it makes a lot of sense. I've worked with Brad Brecky from Target, who I know is one of the supporters of this bill. I've worked with some of the security chiefs from other major retailers that are operating in the St. Paul area. They support the bill, and I think it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Senator Newman, I know that this bill or variations of this bill have been around for a number of years. I want to commend you for bringing it forward. We can't get it all done this year, but we can make a sizable step in the right direction. I don't know if too many people know this, but during my college years, I worked for Dayton Hudson Corporation as a security, retail security person. And so I'd commonly chase guys through parking lots and get thrown around hoods of cars and other things trying to get a record album back. But didn't pay much then, but it may have paid a little bit more than what I'm getting paid now at this job. But nevertheless, I wanted to thank you again, and for the people in our retail community, I know that hopefully there's a little help on the way. So
thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if I may, Mr. Ferris is also, Mr. Ferris is also here. He'd like to just add a few words, and then I will make my motion, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you. My name is Randy Ferris. I am the Senior Director of Loss Prevention for SuperValue, and I have been in the retail food and drug industry since 1973 and in the security loss prevention arena since 1981. And I'm pleased to be here today in support of Senate File 680, which is going to add a valuable tool for prosecutors, law enforcement, and retailers to prosecute organized retail theft. SuperValue is one of the largest retail grocers in the country. We are headquartered here in Minnesota. We have almost 4,300 stores across the United States that we either own directly or support through our network of distribution centers throughout the country. In the state of Minnesota, we operate under the name of Cub Foods, Hornbacher's, and Save-A-Lot, and we also support and supply other independent retailers that you know as Lunds and Byerly's, Kowalski's, and Coburn's. Organized retail crime is costing SuperValue about $25 million a year. $5 million of that is about what we are losing within the state of Minnesota. And it's not just the retailers that are hurt, but the citizens of Minnesota are impinged upon by having to pay higher prices as we try to fund more security products. They are inconvenienced by having to find employees to unlock locked cases where some of the higher risk product is contained. And they are further infringed upon, as has been mentioned earlier, in that the illegal sale of that product that has been stolen does not generate any sales tax revenue for the state, and therefore the citizens do not get to benefit from the programs that that sales tax would have helped them with. On the West Coast, the leaders of organized retail crime have been connected to international terrorist groups, South American crime consortiums, and other organized crime enterprises. And it's important to know that these organized retail crime hubs, which are located in Southern California, Florida, New York, and New Jersey, have spread their tentacles outside of their home states by sending operatives around the country. It is not uncommon when we stop somebody that fits the value and modus operandi of organized retail crime practitioners to see that their vehicles are tagged with license plates from those coastal cities. Just last year, we deterred a man who was trying to defraud us on gift cards, turned his license plate number over to local police, who found that he had hit most of the large retailers in the state of Minnesota before dropping his car over at the Humphrey Terminal and boarding a plane for Baltimore. Our stolen products, such as the baby formulas and the health and beauty aids and razor blades, go from the hands of the boosters to the fences who sell them online, not only on Craigslist and eBay, where you hear a lot of publicity about this, but also on hundreds and hundreds of unregulated websites. A year or so ago, we tracked product that was stolen from one of our stores in Utah to a distribution center outside of Atlantic City, New Jersey, where it was then sold on a website that was run from Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. Theft and organized retail crime is on the rise. We have seen our average shoplifting stop raise 46% over the last 3 years. But our stores are not the only operations that are being targeted. Several years ago, we suffered a loss of $250,000 in baby formula that was taken during a six-month period of time at one of our Minnesota distribution centers. So once you see the enormity of the losses and the intricacy of the fencing and the networking of the logistics operations, there's no doubt that this is truly an organized criminal enterprise in every sense of the meaning of those words. Additionally, as was mentioned, when that product, especially products such as formula and health and beauty aids, over-the-counter medicines, leave our control, They are often have the expiration dates removed and are no longer in temperature-controlled environments, meaning the people that buy them no longer can be sure of the quality and integrity of that product. We support ORC legislation at the federal level and within every state that we operate, and we are happy to support it here in Minnesota. There is no doubt that as the laws and enforcement increase on the two coasts, that the purveyors of organized retail crime will look towards the interior states where the laws and the enforcement is not as strict. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions of the witness, of the testifier? Thank you. Chair Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move at this time that Senate file 680 be recommended to pass and move to the Senate floor.
Senator Newman moves that Senate file number 680 as amended be recommended to pass and move where, Senator Newman?
To the floor.
To the floor. And any further discussion, Senator Letts?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I had to step out. What's the explanation on the fiscal note and where's the funding coming from?
Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Letts, Amendment A1 deleted sections 1 and 2, so all we're left with is section 3, which adds general theft to the RICO Act. The fiscal note was drawn to what would result if sections 1 and 2 had been enacted. So A1 essentially took care of the problem of the fiscal note.
Any further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak for or against the bill? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there any further business before the committee?
Okay, we're done.
Yep. Hearing none, meeting adjourned.
If you can do that, I would.